don't worry about your track. Just keep it running until we're done.
Yep. All right. Very, very happy with how the main went. And now that we are behind the paywall, we can continue the discussion and maybe even get a little bit spicier. Andy and I were like playing around with doing something like Doug Lane used to have with the Parrot Room, like calling it something when we go behind the paywall and talk shit about people. But we haven't isolated one yet. Andy, you got any more ideas? Andy's got nothing.
Yeah, sorry. I was just pouring some mate. Sure. We can call it the Mate Cafe.
Yeah, that sounds like a place where you would have a ruthless critique. The Mate Cafe. Let me start it off. Ted Reese, you're back. We're in the bonus here. Great main. I'm thinking about, and I was thinking about when I read your book, the legacy of the second and third internationals and the kind of theory that's been passed down. We played around with the idea of why is it that the critique or the analysis that Grossman picks up ends up becoming marginalized and fringe, even though, as you argue, and I think it's convincing, there was a core of Marx's work, obviously capitalism being historically specific, necessitating its own overcoming in a deterministic, semi-deterministic capacity. But yet, there are so many harmonists around now. Neo-harmonism, or harmonism, whatever you want to call it, is rife right now. Building, I think, off of like a lot of what happened in the 20th century, seeming as though capitalism, even up until now, has not run out of its growing capacity. I think one of the places you see this the most are by Dungists or supporters of the CPC, the Communist Party of China, and President Xi, many of whom argue that through state intervention, through ownership of the commanding heights of the economy, through banking, the creation of state-owned enterprises in large swaths, and a very strong regulatory hand of the state, that China, the Chinese Communist Party, has overcome the crisis tendency. They would argue that what you're seeing right now with Evergrande, which is the largest real estate and development company in China and maybe the world, there's been a default, but like a slow motion kind of puncturing of their real estate market through what they call the three red lines, right? People use this as an argument that while China has opened itself up to development, to capitalist development, to markets, that the Communist Party, that good Marxists can create harmonious development, that you can have a crisis-free capitalism so long as various different regulations are in place. What do you think about that argument? What do you think about what's happening in China right now? What do you think the proponents of neo-harmonism are going to be saying when this great crisis, as we know is coming, actually comes?
With regards to, I mean, that's a really good question. With regards to China, I mean, I would say China's having less problems than the US and Western Europe, because its capital is younger. Essentially, it's the overaccumulation relative to the size of the economy isn't as great. Its interest rates are higher, but they've still been falling progressively over the last 20, 30 years. So that shows us that really it has the same essential problems as elsewhere, just on not quite as great a basis yet. Because I say it's younger, so it's been able to invest in newer technology, it's been able to be at the cutting edge of innovation because of that. So it has some advantages, and maybe China will be able to kick the can down the road a bit longer than other places. Or maybe China will be able to become the dominant capitalist power before capitalism ends absolutely. Or maybe the Chinese Communist Party has been right all along and they're waiting for that moment and then they're just going to nationalize. I mean, they might have to, though. They might have to, like, if And there have been certain studies arguing that they've started to reintroduce more social enterprises in the last decade or so than they were doing before. They were sort of doing the opposite, and even though they're still, like, it's mainly privatization, they're still producing or developing some social enterprises than they were, whereas here that doesn't happen at all. So there's obviously still a strong left influence of some sort in the Chinese leadership, but at the same time, do they react to the crisis by going, oh no, we actually need to privatize more now or allow more investment in? You know, that's how they might react to the crisis that way.
You've seen that. I was pointing on Twitter last week. It was after I recorded the China episode with Varm, but it was last week. And what you've seen on a local level, and I think we all know that the Chinese political system is very opaque, and also that there's a great sort of disconnect between local cadres, of course, in the Politburo and Xi on top. But what was in the paper in the Financial Times was a story about how on local levels in some provinces, you've started to see deregulation, especially of the labor market.
Yeah.
So party officials saying that there'd be a, whatchamacallit, like a pullback on laws about forced overtime, pullback on laws about like laws defending people against wage theft, that they were trying to basically on a local level set the conditions for accumulation again by cutting back on labor rights. And I don't think that that necessarily comes from the top down. I'm not saying that that's where things go, but when you've, you know, jettisoned the developmental regime, you know, starting in the 70s, and you only have certain strings to pull on anymore, and the private economy has taken up more and more, these are the sort of things that people with an eye towards expanded accumulation look towards, you know, necessarily, without some other sort of plan, without some sort of like Marxist or communist intervention in there. So it's an interesting question about what it's
about
China.
I mean, I read that the share of GDP that went to Chinese billionaires doubled in 2020. From 10% to 20% or something like that, which is an astounding figure, and I think, you know, a pretty sure sign of severe decay setting into what I would call Chinese capitalism. So, I mean, in terms of the neo-harmonists in general, that's what happens. You know, it's the last line of defense for capitalism. Is to try and obscure the breakdown theory as much as possible. You know, misdirection plays a very important role in reducing class consciousness and fighting against socialist forces. So I think that's just where that comes from. Maybe partly it's just denial, wishful thinking. But, you know, I was saying yesterday, Grossman points out in the full version of his book, which is only came into was only translated into English last year. Which is an absolute travesty. I can't believe we've allowed that to happen. But anyway, he says in that Marx is disheartened in his letters to Engels about how little impact his crisis theory has made within the workers' movements. And of course, Grossman goes on to suffer the same fate, effectively. And but maybe a final breakdown theory only becomes relevant to enough people for it to count for something in a final breakdown. Maybe that's what has to happen, like on a you know, in terms of a material analysis for why it's never taken off in popularity, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, there's something very imminent about the way that socialists imagine the project, imagine what they have to build, based on the sort of background ambient environment, because we all know that original revisionism arrives in the 1890s in a period of tremendous growth where it seemed like capital had overcome its contradictions. You start to see crisis theory again in the Anglophone world, at least, and in Germany and other places in Europe, start to really be popularized again in the 1970s, another moment of crisis. But then it appears then for the next 30, 40 years, or at least until 2008, that harmony has won the day again, and we're simply standing on the sidelines and maybe doing political calls to action to workers based on a very sort of line-centric or tendency-centric sort of like understanding of how, let's say, Leninist political struggle develops itself. But now we're here on the cusp of a crisis, and it seems as though Grossman's relevance, the relevance that you've kind of plucked out of obscurity, you and Rick Kuhn there, is probably really important for the kind of militants that listen to this show and other shows, and are studying and struggling on their own times to get their heads around.
Yeah, I mean that's the aim of my work in the end, is to try and bolster our arguments for why socialism is not just desirable but necessary and increasingly so. And I think so. What I'm trying to do is rehabilitate Marx via Grossman, but that also requires the rehabilitation of Grossman, because I think when Marx and Capital have been discredited to the extent that they have, you need all the help you can get to reverse that, and I think Grossman makes the best fist of it. Obviously, my book is only really an introduction to Grossman, because I think that's what's needed. If I had more time, I would have done something more substantial. But the least I could do was get out an introduction, a sort of introductory summary, because I think his politics are. Reflect his economics, and they're just as important as each other. His letters to Paul Mattick are really interesting in that way.
Yeah, let's get into that because I think this is essential. And it's funny, I'm thinking about like, so if Grossman publishes his Law of Accumulation 3 months before the Great Crisis of 1929, maybe that means if yours was published last week, we have like, how many weeks would that be? I don't know. 15 weeks until the next Great Crisis comes.
I mean, I think we're probably in a technical recession now, because the first 3 months were the US had unexpectedly severe negative growth in the first 3 months of this year. So unless that's been reversed in the last 3 months, which is optimistic. Then we might be in the first technical recession since 2008-09 now, which is crazy to think about that they've managed to stave it off for that long. And they've only been able to do that through, severe austerity, privatization, and accumulation of debt.
Yeah, world historic levels of liquidity pumping into the economy, quantitative easing, obviously bailing out the financial system. God, it seems like 14 years of a rocky sort of recovery that was, as you said, massive debt load right now, covering up for the fact that we never actually left 2008, which was like a signal crisis for the seemingly terminal one we're going into. Let's talk about the politics of this, but first let's talk about this debt overhang because Varn and I are going to talk about debt, the debt crisis coming up pretty soon. There's been debt crises throughout capitalism. The amount that you itemize or that you show in your book from various different studies, including some from very reputable bourgeois institutions like the IMF, show a corporate household and government debt levels of hundreds of trillions of dollars right now. Each
Is that the same
every
thing as fictitious capital?
Effectively, yeah.
each of the like the each one of those dollars is a claim on future value production, right? They need to be made real by entering into the production process and coming out the other side. When you get levels that high, it seems to me that it is fictitious, right? That it is ultimately money chasing money, M to M prime. and that, well, I'll let you speak on it. Tell us a little bit about the debt overhang and what it means and what it might lead to.
I mean, it's essentially plugging the gap where you have this underproduction of surplus value. It's filled by debt to keep the circulation of capital going, the turnover or the cash flow, to incentivize banks to lend out money, because the more debt there is, the more the interest rate tends to be suppressed or pushed downwards. It's all of those things. It's a reflection of the basic tendency that as capital accumulates, the rate of profit tends to fall proportionally. Like that's just a general rule in capital. So it's all of these things, and yeah, like the fact that it's now higher, or a year into the pandemic, it was higher than at the end of World War II. It's just extraordinary, because obviously we haven't had a world war, and although the levels of spending on during the pandemic were something similar in proportional terms, it was already very high before even 2008, and then, you know, it's just accelerated since then.
Andy, did you have something? I was going to ask about the common turn.
Yeah, I want to talk about the common turn too. I'm just like, you know, I'm trying to process a bit these questions of these so-called worker states, or like actually existing socialist states, are dealing with the questions of breakdown theory. I mean, obviously, historically, there was denial, disputing Grossman. But then, obviously, with the breakdown of the Soviet Union, you saw something like the real effect of that. Like you mentioned Cuba before. Once the Soviet economic sphere breaks down, you suddenly have Cuba starving, and it arguably you could say that led to some kind of socialist measures in dealing with that, but largely it led to a kind of neoliberalization process in Cuba. And I'm wondering like how things could go the other way. Like let's say the socialist bureaucracies that still exist embrace Grossman and try to use breakdown to kickstart class struggle as it emerges. I don't know what that would look like.
That's what I'm going for. Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question, because you have to go into the whole arguments of, you know, does a revolution have to be external? Does it have to start externally to the state? You know, does a vanguard operation of one sort or another have to, you know, help to push forward the emerging struggles on the streets and taking it in a certain direction? Or can it be a top-down thing that already exists, that's already in place? I mean, Cuba's in...
It seems like the state hangs on in these scenarios. So it's kind of, you know, even if the economy's breaking down, the state seems to persist to some degree.
Well, let's look at what we have. We have state monopoly capitalism, a late stage of state monopoly capitalism. What does that mean? It means the state and private capital are becoming ever more intertwined. So by that I mean that private capital accumulation is increasingly dependent on the state for subsidies, contracts and facilities. So for example, the pharmaceutical industry has more or less closed down all of its own research and development, and now uses almost exclusively state facilities for its own research and development, because it couldn't afford to keep its own R&D departments open. That's the extent to which the state is merging with capital. I actually see this as a kind of a pre-socialist trend, because like neoliberalism was supposed to be, or we were told that neoliberalism was all about shrinking the state. In some ways that's happened in terms of the number of imp- people employed by the state directly, in terms of like the, like, I don't know how it's gone in the US, but in Britain, I think something like 20% of the police force was made redundant, or 20,000 cops or whatever was were made redundant after the Great Recession. And the in the armed forces, they're increasingly employing like 17-year-olds because that's all they can afford to employ and that sort of thing. So the state on that front is getting weaker, but it's getting more powerful in terms of like subsuming everything, because private capital is so dependent on it for those three things. So I kind of see that as a pre-socialist trend, because what's the next evolutionary step of like state monopoly capitalism? It would have to be what you might call state monopoly socialism, where like we've see also like at the same time as what I've just described, we see like the increasing monopolization of the ownership of the means of production, where we see more and more mergers and fewer companies dominating each industry. So really, like, what is happening historically is a move towards a final merger, and that would have to be a that would have to be done on a socialist basis. You can't have capitalism without competition. But that's not going to happen, because the ruling class goes, oh, we don't have any other option but to take all ownership of everything under the state. They're just going to try and give more subsidies to the private companies, more contracts to them, and more facilities. That so you see the state and the military and the biggest monopolies, especially, sort of merging together now. But like I say, what they're going to do is try and press down the outlay on wages as much as they can, and the privatize as much as they can, come up with as many new commodities as they can think of, you know, keep innovating and so on. But this just in the end reproduces the same problem on a greater scale. So I mean, in terms of Cuba, like, they're just in a really difficult situation where to try and fend off the aggression of the US and beyond, they're making concessions, because that, you know, the thinking being, well, they'll leave us alone a bit more if we give them a few more concessions. And then, I mean, the same thing actually happened in Venezuela after the coup attempt by Guido. I don't know if I've said his name right, but what didn't really get talked about is that Maduro did make quite significant concessions to capital to calm that situation down. So this is the problem. This is the class struggle. You know, it's a back and forth struggle, and capitalism. But eventually, capitalism has to run out of things to privatize, right? It has to run out of things to commodify. So again, there's it's sort of running out of options on all fronts. So, but it can't come from a top down thing. I mean, Marx does say a portion of the bourgeoisie will end up siding with the proletarian revolution because it won't really have any other option. And the other thing I would say is, and this is another reason why I'm a state socialist, quote unquote, is that you are going to need quite a lot of defections from people who currently work from the state, because they know how to run a state. They've got the training that the contemporary means of production need. Like, when you're talking about automation and, you know, alongside that, science has become the helmsman of production. You know, you can't just expect people who have never been trained in certain areas of production to be able to pick it up overnight. So there's that factor. There's the factor of, you know, people who have experienced military situations and know how to act in those situations. So you're going to need mutinies and defections before it's even possible. I think, like, the idea that the civilian population can defeat the state on its own is quite fanciful. I think it's going to be a bit of both.
You mentioned the UK. Let's bring things to the United States for a second, because this is really interesting. You know, people on this podcast and elsewhere all over the place, with the Bernie Sanders movement popping up and then fizzling, millennial leftism or whatever, there's all these questions, you know, why is there no Labor Party in the United States? Why is the level of class struggle so low? There's many answers to that, but one of them is that America is the key hegemonic capitalist imperialist power in the world. And if you read somebody like John Smith about hyper-exploitation and unequal exchange, or world systems theorists, and all of the ill-gotten booty through patents and IP and military power and controlling the global reserve currency, all of the advantages that the United States has from its overwhelming power to facilitate and dictate the terms of private accumulation. And an interesting, something that's never happened, we can start to see the potential that may be happening, which is that the United States, as the guarantor, as the consumer of last resort, as the military policer, as the facilitator of capital accumulation, might face sometime in the next few years, maybe in the next decade or two, a situation that it itself cannot resolve by pulling on all the levers that we saw it pull in 2008. You know, I'm agnostic on whether, you know, the global reserve currency of the US dollar or the treasury, whatever you want to call it, is currently in decline. But just imagine in the year of our Lord 2022, if something on the order of 2008 were to happen again, and imagine the Federal Reserve and the Congress having to come out with another series of policy interventions in order to patch things together again. It seems unlikely to me that you could throw another $100 trillion at the economic problems that we have in capitalism, that the United States could remain on top. So maybe, and this again, I think, goes back to the politics of this, or at least like our understanding of crises being different in different time periods, because maybe the question of why is there no socialism in the United States is a question of, it just hasn't, our hegemonic power hasn't reached the crisis moment yet necessary in order to compel people who are otherwise struggling, maybe, you know, but have their homes and have their decent jobs. Maybe we're going to start seeing vastly different social and economic conditions under which, say, the American working class or German working class or British working class will have to struggle under in order to have some modicum of survival.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, I think it's different for different sections of the working class. I think there's sort of one sect, like the mass of the working class, that is being attacked and finding itself, like, being attacked so much and finding itself having to make concessions, because the better off parts of the working class don't need to, like, side with them, sort of thing. So I think it's probably partly a case of, like, needing a crisis where those layers are also affected in a big way before, like, the working class can, like, start to fight back as a whole. But even that, it's going to be a process. Like, it's going to be part of the working class starts fighting back, and then a bigger part starts fighting back, and then a bigger part than that, and then people on the other side will start, you know, defecting, and all that sort of stuff is going to have to happen. There's definitely, like, a process that you really have to understand, just in social terms. I'm not a pure economic determinist. I definitely have thoughts on the social side of things, and how, and even, like, the psychological and the ethical side of things. Like, my argument is not there won't be a revolution. Well, I don't think there'll be a revolution for psychological and ethical reasons. I think that the essential reasons will be the economic, technical reasons that I laid out. But the way people experience it might be ethical and psychological. They will definitely play very big roles in how things actually play out in our sort of subjective realm. But we are also an objective force ourselves, because, as I say, we're being compelled by the objective force of the economic situation. But yeah, I mean, I can't really say when or what's going to happen exactly. I would just say anticipated it, and anticipate that it might start kicking off sooner than you might expect. But you know, if they can, I mean, they might get through the next crisis by privatizing everything, you know, and pushing wages right down. But that might only give them another 10 years, like, after that sort of thing. So it's hard to say completely, like, the absolute timeline. How deep into negative rates could they go? You know, if, let's just say, they could go -15, -20% into negative baseline rates, and the system still be functional to some degree, they will try to do that. But I don't know if that's possible. It's impossible. There's no way of actually being able to tell if that's possible or not, but they will try it.
I was thinking about, like, if we're going to put some music to the episode, I want to have a song that has a really good breakdown. You know, obviously I'm thinking along the lines of hardcore, but I don't know what kind of music you listen to. So
is the final showdown? Is that a song?
The final countdown. And there is kind of a breakdown in that. So yeah, that might be the way to go.
I think you ended off with a bang. We could call the main episode, like, the thought of, or Henrik Grossman, the final countdown, or something like that.
Yeah, that'll be the really bonus. Good. The main episode will have hardcore breakdowns.
Hell yeah. Cool. Need that shit. I don't disagree with you on the merger of state and capital. I recently reread Marx and Keynes by Paul Maddox Sr. He was making similar arguments about what's happening in the 1960s and 1970s. I think maybe the big takeaway for me is that our interpretation, us as militants, you know, on whatever side of the pond that we're on, our interpretation is historically determined based on, you know, what state capitalism is in. I wonder, and this is my Comintern question, I wonder if there was, after the publishing of Law of Accumulation, maybe other choices that the Comintern, the communist movement in general, could have made if they had had the breakdown theory on the front burner the entire time, which is to say, I wonder what breakdown theory can do for us politically and agitationally. What do you think?
I mean, I think potentially Grossman's book was rejected because the situation so the Soviet Union found itself in was, you know, on the isolated and on the back foot, and though they were trying to build socialism there, they became, you know, they had a situation where they didn't have the capacity to spread it, sort of thing. So they effectively had a reformist foreign policy, even if you support the idea, which Grossman did, that they were building socialism there. So I kind of, because he, in his letters to Matic, he agrees that he doesn't particularly like Stalin and the rest of the leadership, but he says that it was kind of almost inevitable that it ended up going that way because of its isolation and its inability to import certain materials, and, you know, it couldn't plan everything because it had to trade with capitalist states where it could circumvent sanctions, so it couldn't predict, like, fluctuating prices from capitalist countries and that sort of thing. So I think, like, Grossman understands why it's the socialism of the Soviet Union was distorted and why the leadership became conservative, like relatively conservative. But as I said earlier, like if we're in a final breakdown, like it's always going to be impossible to know if we're in a final breakdown until like world socialism is secured, sort of thing. Then we know we've been through the final breakdown for sure. But as I say, like I think the combination of Grossman's theory reinforcing both Marx's theory and being reinforced by the compelling empirical evidence that we now have, I think the combination of those is very powerful for agitational purposes. Because it's just undeniable when you look at it, when you look at all the secular trends and how close to zero we are on so many fronts, whether it's prices of production, obviously before inflation, because they're trying to, partly the inflation is being caused because they're trying to like cut down on production in order to get prices back up. But historically speaking, the prices of production have fallen almost absolutely now towards zero. GDP growth has been slowing for 50 years and hasn't been much higher than zero in the last couple of decades. Interest rates stuck at zero, having fallen in a secular trend towards zero, usually takes a 6% cut to end a recession. So are they going to be able to do that this time? You know, all these different things, the return on energy investment, it's all very compelling, and it's what makes me a Marxist. If you could convince me that capitalism can go on forever, I'd probably look at the last century and go, yeah, probably. And there's probably no point in being a socialist. You know, you might as well be a harmonist and a reformist. Because, and this is the thing, while, and this is partly why the Soviet Union ended, or was they had the ability to destroy the Soviet Union and turn it into a capitalist, restore capitalism there, is while there has been an exploitable labour base, capitalism has been possible. But that labour base is being innovated away now, necessarily in both economic and technical terms. And so, like, in some ways the Soviet Union was emerged prematurely. Like, I'm not denouncing the Bolsheviks for trying when they did. I support what they did. It doesn't really matter, but I'm sort of critically supportive of the Soviet Union as a political project. Well, yeah, I don't think it is all that matters by any means, but, you know, I support it and try and put it in the context, but I also, in the correct context of its isolation and, you know, imperialist pressures and all the rest of it. I'm not like a Stalinist in particular, or a Trotskyist in particular, or, you know, I'm just sort of like a Marxist. I think there are lessons, very important lessons to learn from all of the communist leaders that have made revolutions and led revolutionary projects. But now I think is the time of Marx. I mean, I don't know, but I just think he is important again. I think he's always been important, but I think he's important again. And, you know, it's worth citing his work to reinforce Marx's.
100%. I guess to finish things off, maybe one other political speculation. I wonder if we take on Grossman's theory, the breakdown theory, the final crisis, if we make this part of our package, you know, part of our tool belt, or at least part of our agitation. And if we do consider that, you know, we might be facing this sooner rather than later, I wonder if it changes the political valence of things like, say, mutual aid versus party building. I wonder if it changes the way we think about questions of like Yeah, like line building versus like embeddedness in working class life and creating quote unquote economic organizations, maybe syndicalist organizations versus merely political ones. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Does it change any of the tasks at hand to have a breakdown theory? Does it change our practice at all?
I mean, yeah, I think it means abandoning reformism. Not completely, because I get like the dialectic between reformism and revolution. I think you have to have a united front. I think a vanguard communist party or a vanguard communist organization that is trying to seize state power and take the means of production under social ownership, or vice versa, in terms of building dual power and Soviets and all the rest of it. I think it needs to have a tactical position of taking up the united front in terms of like critical support for reformist movements that are genuinely progressive, with an eye to winning over the members of those movements, if you like, when those movements fail, or when they get into a position where we can say you're only going to hold on to this if you go all the way, sort of thing. I'm not saying we can repeat the Russian Revolution by any means, but they had this sort of dual position where they had what I just described on one hand, and then on the other hand they would have to hold back to a certain extent, like the newly converted, who were like over enthusiastic because Lenin was like stressing that you've got to win over the majority of the working class before you can make any attempt at power through you've got to do that through systematic class struggle. Like the class struggle is the struggle to convert the majority of the working class. So I think that's my position. I don't discount the need to do mutual aid. You know, we've got to stay alive if we're going to be able to do a revolution as well. So, but yeah, building communes, building anything that pulls resources and builds solidarity has got to be a step in the right direction as well. But like people who want to get to the position where we can have a socialist state that can reverse the breakdown in production and go beyond anything that capitalism has achieved in terms of the abundant capacity for production, then I think that's the tactical stance that we have to start taking very seriously. And it means a break from reformism, but not a total break. Like it needs to be situated like properly and sensibly, because if you break too far ahead, you tend to run ahead of you tend to like there's Taylorism on the one side where you're too reformist, but you can also run ahead too far ahead, I think, of the masses and the sort, because in a revolutionary, if you look at the German Revolution, like what happened, most of the workers that became politically active and militant joined reform. They joined the SPD. Like the SPD was, its membership was far greater than the Communist Party's ever was. Throughout that four years after the First World War and beyond that. And you know the Communist Party did shoot itself in the foot at times where it was too aggressive towards the reformists. So it switched from a united front from above, which was addressing the leaders of the reformist movement, to only addressing the membership. And that, ironically, tended to mean that they didn't actually address the membership as well as they could have done if they had addressed the leadership. So yeah, it's a mix of all sorts of things. You know, I think, you know, anyone struggling with inflation and the rising prices has got to be thinking about pooling resources with neighbors, you know, with any organisations they're in. We definitely need a coalescence of, you know, any political project is going to be a coalition in the end. It is. And we have to find, not middle ground, but we have to find areas where that we can agree on and move forward together. And there will be concessions. No one's going to get everything they want straight away. It's only when production under socialism reaches a certain level, I think, a certain level of abundance, that the state can start withering away. I don't think you can get rid of the state before you've achieved abundance, and vice versa. You can't get to a post-scarcity politics before you've gotten rid of the state, because as production breaks down, power's concentrating into fewer hands. We're already seeing that quite aggressively now. So yeah, all of those things have got to be taken into account.
That's a good answer. Andy, did you have anything to add before we sign off?
No, I mean, I don't like that conclusion. You know, I wish I could make a Bookchinite argument against it, or some kind of autonomist claim that actually production will be better in the communes. But, you know, I think everything you're saying is pretty sound. And yeah, I think this kind of thinking about the relationship between breakdown and class struggle and the subjective and objective forces are really one of the most important things we can be thinking about right now. So, yeah, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Ted, this was great. And I think I did the math wrong before. So in 11 weeks, when the final crisis comes, that is to say 3 months after your book came out for Zero, we'll have you back, maybe, and we can do it. Or maybe it'll be 3 years or something like that. But regardless, this has been excellent. Thank you so much. This is one of my favorite episodes we've done lately. So cheers, man.